Well, good morning, and it's starting off, it's really nice to see so many of the faces that I saw yesterday when I was speaking in London. And for your benefits, I sat up this morning and especially made sure that what I'm going to say today doesn't duplicate what I said yesterday. So gone is the joke about my dream last night. Doug illustrated a lot of his talk with before and after pictures. And I think it's probably just as relevant that we talk about contemporary issues by understanding where we've come from historically as well, in order to understand where we still need to go. I was thinking this morning that it's actually probably not generally realised that it's 77 years since Lily Elbe had her groundbreaking gender reassignment surgery in Denmark. It's more than 50 years since the press covered Christine Jorgensen and Roberta Cowell's gender reassignment in the UK and Denmark. It's almost 40 years since April Ashley got married and then got divorced, and the case that followed, which obviously changed people's legal status for an awful long time after that. And around that same time, it was also the point at which the mould was cast for how gender reassignment or gender services were organised in the UK, certainly, with the development of the services that involved John Randall at Charing Cross Hospital. And just as the way in which those services developed... what happened to April Ashley affected people's legal status for a long time and defined part of the agenda there. Of course, how those services have been set up at Charing Cross have really defined the health landscape as well. Of course, the April Ashley case triggered what I would call the long, dark days. In fact, not days, not months, but nearly 30 years. Of being on the outside of society. So just a tribute to show what legal status can actually do to people overall. And all of that set the parameters for what we confront today. In marriage, of course, we've come a long way now because of the Gender Recognition Act, but we still need to address a lot of family issues, particularly in terms of families being able to stay together. A lot of that is associated with greater social understanding and awareness of the fact that families involving trans people can and do flourish, and we really ought to give as much support as we're able to ensure that they have every best chance of doing so. Until only fairly recently, trans people had no employment security. They still have no security against discrimination in the supply of goods and services until the end of this coming year. And medicine over these last 30 years has been defined in the UK on lines which I would struggle to even call third class, certainly the bottom of the barrel. I would look upon some of the ways in which it has been influenced as being having an awful lot in parallel with the backstreet type of services, which were the only thing available to women who got pregnant before we legalised abortion in this country. It takes a long time to make changes to bring people into the mainstream, even when you've changed the law. But let's move forward. So the mid-1980s were the years that actually started to set the seeds of change. Mark Rees, around between 1984 and 1987, taking his case all the way through the legal system to the European Court of Human Rights. He lost, of course, but at least he showed that it was possible, if we got the arguments right, to win. And 4 or 5 years later, Caroline Cossey tried again, and what she showed, although she lost, was that things were moving, because the majority against finding in her favour in the European Court had diminished. And so it went on, in fact, to 1998 with Sheffield and Horsham going through the European Court of Human Rights. That was down to the point that if one judge, the English judge, had actually voted the other way, we'd have won at that point. Let's stay with this timeline. Press for Change was founded in 1992. The Gender Trust, of course, as we know it today, was founded around about 1990. This was the point in time when trans people started to get our act together in terms of organising, first to support ourselves, and second to actually do some concerted effort to change things using the law and using the power of our advocacy. Even then, we achieved very little in the first 4 or 5 years. It was actually only in 1996 that we had our first win with the case of P versus S and Cornwall County Council, which, as probably most of you know, then went on to be incorporated into the law through what a child. There's always long names for these things. The Sex Discrimination Gender Reassignment Regulations of 1999. And I have to take a breath. So, with that change in 1996, and with Sir Alex Carlisle attempting to put a private member's bill through Parliament, which, going back, actually looks disarmingly similar in some ways to the Gender Recognition Act as it is today, we really embarked on a period of around about 8 years when almost all of our efforts were focused on legal change. So, following P versus S and the SDA regulations, in the same year, 1999, the appeal court case of AD&G versus Northwest Lancs Health Authority established a very important principle that it was unlawful for, in those days, a health authority, these days read a primary care trust, to operate a system which amounted to a blanket ban on treatment. And when we're talking about treatment here, we're not talking about funding gender reassignment surgery, because everybody seems to think it's all about that, but actually simply about referring people to specialists who are equipped to be able to help them because of their understanding of the condition and what they're going through. It's odd that in a service it's all about care, that it could be so good at brutalising people, and that it should be so hard to get people to accept the case that actually referring people to get help, which needn't involve them actually having surgery, is an important thing to do, especially if we're looking at the statistics, which we now know from some research last year, indicate that people who don't get help with their dysphoria, over 34% of them that we've surveyed reported they considered suicide one or more times. And I always have to say to groups of people that I want to emphasise that that's not to do with the urban myth that people have their surgery or have their treatment and then regret it and then go and commit suicide. In fact, the rate of regret, in spite of people trying to drum up an idea that it's otherwise in the press, is very, very small. This is actually one of the most successful medical treatments on record. If you're looking at heart surgery, then doctors think they're actually doing well if they get a 60 or 65% success rate. That's acceptable. In gender treatment, we're talking around the high 90s. So, you know, why is it so difficult to accept that this is such an important thing to do? Following the AD&G case, we also, of course, then won finally in the European Court of Human Rights in 2002. We're coming up to the fifth anniversary since that, July the 11th, 2002. And rather like Kennedy's assassination, I can remember where I was and what I was doing when the phone rang and Stephen told me. So, as I say, we spent about 8 or 9 years just simply working on these legal matters. But I do want to stress that the problem with just simply changing the law is that it doesn't change attitudes. It doesn't change life for people. All it does is to draw a line in the sand. It says, this is what society currently regards as being acceptable or unacceptable behaviour. But it doesn't still stop people trying to carry on in their own way. You've actually got to change their hearts and their minds. Not appeal to their fear of having sanctions applied to them through the courts. So that really sets the scene on where we are now, because I refer to it as the post-legislative agenda. And I wish I'd pick a word that was easier to say. It's about furthering the effects of employment protection, because although we've got these regulations which say it's unlawful to discriminate in employment or vocational education against somebody who is planning to undergoing or has undergone gender reassignment treatment, there are a number of flaws about that. First, it only covers employment and vocational education. There's a third part of the Sex Discrimination Act which the government found that it decided it couldn't or didn't want to implement at the same time. Ministers can always find extremely good excuses, and actually, as we think that they could, the courts could certainly interpret the P versus S decision more widely than legislative law might actually allow us to legislate. By the end of this year, in fact by December the 21st to be precise, we must have law on the statute book that protects people, trans people, against discrimination in the supply of goods and services. That's because that is the last day by which this country must have a legal implementation of the gender directive from the European community. But we also obviously need to work on the fact that people still get discriminated, and a disarmingly large number of people report that they need to move on following transition at work, and not because they simply want to do so for the benefit of their career, but because they feel pressured to do so. I do wonder, actually, to what degree some of that actually is bound up with the sort of things we were discussing earlier this morning. You know, the visible acceptability of individuals counts for an awful lot, and I've been known to argue that actually it's much more important to get this bit right than the other bits right, because most of us will never ever see the genitals of the people that we actually work with and interact with. You're not going to see mine, I'll tell you that. So, you know, we gender people in very different ways. We look at their face. I've published an article on the internet which I cheekily called 23 hours and 57 minutes, because those genital bits, which are of interest only to people who we are intimately involved with, you know, if we're particularly unlucky, we have a very unsensitive lover, then they may only be important for 3 minutes in the day. But the other 23 hours and 57 minutes we spend interacting with the world, and it's actually top down. It starts from the hair, the face, and the rest of the look of the person, and how they sound, and so on. If those factors are right, then of course there's no space for discrimination, because people don't know how to discriminate you from anybody else. So I think that's very important, and I don't think we're really thinking hard enough about our priorities and actually understanding what gender change is about. And we've really got to get it out of people's heads that this is all about the goal of litigation-free removal of somebody's penis or addition of a penis. It's not. It's about this word that's actually used a lot now in health and social care, well-being. It's about the goal. It can actually depend on the individual. It's not for every individual that they need to have surgery. They might not even want to have hormones. What they need is for somebody to be able to help them to find what they are comfortable with. And we need to understand that that population is actually bigger than the population that we've previously measured, because we've only exclusively thought about people who are attending gender clinics with the goal of gender reassignment surgery. So we need to do a lot of rethinking of what we mean. And we're very fortunate, because in the last 2 or 3 years, the Department of Health, through its Equality and Human Rights group, has been focusing a great deal on the whole issue of making the health service a place which upholds everybody's equality and inclusion, and that includes sexual minorities as well. Now, some people don't like the idea that we actually spend a lot of our time doing this with lesbian and gay and bisexual people, but the fact that it actually brings us £250,000 to spend this year on work in this field, I'll make friends with anybody. But actually, we get a lot of support from one another as well, and we find that the discrimination issues are the big issues. They're the attitude issues, and they're the same whether it's because you've had gender reassignment or you just look funny or somebody knows who you would rather go out with and sleep with. So, I mean, we've actually, in our first full year of work, we've been very lucky in being able to publish some just fundamentals. Working together, we produced a leaflet about an introduction to working with transgender people. It's only a tiny little leaflet, but it actually starts, because when you're actually educating Europe's largest employer, the NHS is Europe's largest organisation. It employs well over 1 million people. And you're not going to change that in 5 minutes. You actually have to work very slowly and progressively through all the issues that are involved in changing people's hearts and minds. There's a parallel publication for an introduction to working with lesbian and gay people as well. This one I'm most proud of, because actually this one was actually produced by young people themselves. It's a guide for young trans people in the UK. And this year we've just agreed that we're also going to fund the parallel publication to this, which actually helps and supports people in social care and primary care as well to understand what this is about. But it's a really good read, and I'm really pleased because it actually came from people who are mostly under 18 years of age, all they needed was the help in order to be able to put their words down onto paper, and Central Office of Information to help us publish it. At the other end of life, Bereavement, a Guide for Transsexual, Transgender People and Their Loved Ones. This is a very vulnerable time, whether it's because you're a transgender person and a relative of yours has died, or you're the relative of a transgender person who's died. Either way, there's a lot to understand in order to make sure that that event takes place with dignity. The National Health Service last year had published a booklet called Help Is at Hand, which is intended for everybody else besides trans people to understand and get through those issues. And we looked at that at the time. It was sufficient to put a couple of paragraphs in to cover LGB issues of understanding the type of relationships that people can have, different kinds of next of kin. But we knew that we actually needed an entire booklet to cover the... Oh, dear. Thank God for that. And this really just maps on to a lot of what's simply going on in the health service at the present time. Most useful document, Equality and Human Rights in the NHS. I should download this one off the internet and read it, because its first paragraph explains that the responsibility for ensuring that all emanations of the NHS are free of discrimination and include everybody and recognise diversity falls on chief executives and chairs. They can't delegate it down to someone in HR, they can't delegate it to a diversity specialist, they can't make it not their business, because they're actually going to be measured on this. That's how importantly the issue is taken within the health service. And part of our job is to make sure that we ride that wave and actually we ensure that trans people are completely included during that process. At the same time, in a wider sphere, this year the Equalities Review, which was headed by my pal Trevor Phillips, I say my pal because we spent a whole morning together in a minibus recently, so I know all his most intimate secrets. But I'm not telling yet. We were commissioned as Press for Change to carry out a separate study looking into the extent of discrimination against trans people. The document, which is over 100 pages, entitled Engendered Penalties, again, it's available on the internet, or you can obtain it from the CEHR. It identified huge levels of discrimination within the health service. The data, the primary data that we used, involved 870 trans people. Out of those, 6% reported that they had been refused treatment within the health service. Another 14% said that they felt that their treatment had suffered, that they'd actually not been treated well because of health professionals knowing their trans background. 60% said their GP would like to help but felt unable to do so because of lack of training and lack of information. That's where we're aiming for, that 60% first, because at least there's a possibility there, somebody actually wanting to have more information. I should have explained as well, it's not just about publications, it's not just about training. We're also commissioning the sort of research that has always stood in the way of people. It's the first excuse for people not to do anything. Well, you know, sorry, we've no statistics about trans, therefore we don't need to do anything about it. So we already have about to set off the first proper study, commissioned an independent study of outcomes on people who've used gender services in the last 5 years. We're also commissioning a mapping study to look into what services are available, how they differ and how they compare with other systems in the rest of the world, because it's often forgotten that the way we do gender services in the UK is a UK peculiarity. It's not done this way in America or Australia or other parts of Europe. There are some similarities, but it doesn't have to be done this way. And in fact, when you actually look at it very closely, you find you're in an odd situation of being able to explain to commissioners within the health service that if they actually stepped back and thought about this some more, then in fact, far from this being something that is immensely costly, it can actually be a fraction of what they're paying at the moment. It's only costly because they've been lazy, because for the last 30 years, primary care trusts have said, ooh, that transgender, we don't want to know anything about that. What will we do? I know, we'll just send them to those guys down in Charing Cross. They'll know what to do. And, yeah, we'll just keep paying the bill. And they sort it all out. We don't have any problems. Well, of course, what that does, as it does in any other form of economics, is it allows bad practices to evolve. It allows people to get away with murder. And all these primary care trusts around the country are signing blank checks to services who are quite happy to make treatment last longer than it needs to, because if you can get away with treating for somebody for 3 years rather than 2 years or 1 year, you make an awful lot more money. And if you are just referring and getting no sort of feedback about quality, well, the quality is going to be, pardon my French, crap. Now, these are principles that are fully accepted throughout the rest of the health service. You know, there's a tremendous revolution been going on over the last 10 years, and so far it has largely avoided this area of medicine. Well, we want that to end, and we're going to make it end through what we're doing. So our work continues. We've just planned to spend around about £55,000 so far this year. More research, more literature, more outreach, and really just getting a wave moving for people to say, hang on a minute, we're doing this, and like everything else we do in the health service, we've got to do it properly. So the health agenda is a big one, and we're going to be fighting it for some time, but already we can see that the change is in progress. There's still a lot more for us to do in other areas. You know, we'll still need to see what the implications are in terms of goods and services legislation, because we only had the green paper published this week. We still need to get the wording right on the page when it becomes a law, if it's to be useful. And we need to tackle the whole issue, the fact that all these laws at the moment only deal with people who are defined by their willingness to undergo a surgical procedure. Now, going back to what I said about well-being, what about those other people? What about people who identify as transgender? What about people who cross-dress? What about their families? Because they need support as well. There's a whole area of discrimination that isn't covered by the current concept of how to do it in law. And as I said yesterday, I really can't understand how anybody, if they're actually classing themselves as being concerned about equality, can actually subdivide it. Because if you're concerned about equality, then by definition, then you'll care about everybody's inequality. And to write a law or propose a law that leaves out large swathes of people because you don't want to touch that, you might offend somebody, you're not doing the job. We also still need to tackle the media. The media's got a lot better. But quite frankly, you know, it's not hearing us. It's not representing trans people as happy, successful, articulate people that we are. The images that are still presented through the media are victim images. That's the only way we're allowed to speak. I had a flaming argument with a Guardian journalist about 3 weeks ago because he wouldn't let me say. He asked me for a quote, and then when I gave him a series of quotes, and I always oversupply, I said, you know, you can pick out what you want. Those aren't suitable. They're not what I want you to say. So, being me, I published all of what I'd said through Press for Change's website instead. Next day, I got an irate letter from said journalist saying I should regard this as a formal complaint. He couldn't believe that I'd done this. I'd published our correspondence. And I said, well, actually, all I did was to publish half a sentence of yours. This is my words, and if you won't publish them... So he's gone off in a huff, accusing me of having divided the trans community, of having set doctors against doctors. You know, I think I'm also responsible for the Second World War, but... So there's still a lot to do with the media as well. And in the meantime, because the media won't publish us, we have to do more of what we've been doing for the last decade already through the wonderful thing called the internet, of publishing ourselves so we can exchange our own ideas. In the last 12 months, one of the things, well, this is why I'm carrying a microphone, I've been very keen to do. When we started out on the internet in 1995 with Press for Change, we were publishing ideas. And even then, you know, we were just getting used to being out and considering whether that was, you know, risky, because at the time we started, we didn't have employment protection. We could be sacked like anybody else. We then had this radical idea that wouldn't it be a good idea to publish people's faces? And a nice lady over in America saw what we were doing in that respect and copied it and did it a lot better on a vast scale. Lynn Conway published hundreds of faces. And you notice they're all smiling and happy. I think they've all been to see Doug. So the next step, because people still can't hear us, is to publish people's voices, because people can't hear us. And if you can't see people, then you can carry on discriminating against them as much as you like. So our radical thing of this past 12 months has been to record what we do, to present the conferences we attend, to present people speaking about their ideas, and to be able to, that's for trans people, but it's also for those strangers outside as well, to see that, you know, we're not oddities. We actually are thinking, breathing people who are actually quite nice if you're on the right side of us. So there's plenty still to do, and hopefully we'll carry on doing it, and hopefully there'll be more people to do it, because I'm getting on a bit and I don't want to be doing this in 10 years' time, lovely as you are. Thank you for your time, and enjoy the rest of the conference.